Welcome, welcome, welcome to Jerry Roach's podcast. Continuing with Northern Heights, climbing North America's highest peaks. We're going to jump into chapter 3, More Volcanic Heat, Mount Wrangell, 1964. After my second descent from Rainier, I was in Alaska. After Denali in 1963, I spent the rest of that summer working for the Geophysical Institute at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks. I loved the place, the people, the work, and watching the total solar eclipse had been icing on my summer's bountiful cake. My college education was largely self-financed, and my main source of money came from my summer jobs. I had now spent 3 consecutive summers working, 2 on Maui and 1 in Alaska, and I needed one more summer job to see my degree through to tassel time. When I contacted the Geophysical Institute, they indeed had a job for me, but it was not what I expected. The Institute was one party to a large research grant, whose purpose was to study human high-altitude health issues. The research needed to take place on a high mountaintop, and they needed a high-altitude facility with a support staff. The Institute had already picked a snow-free site near the summit of 14,163-foot Mount Wrangell, which is at the western edge of the Wrangell Mountains, 200 miles east-northeast of Anchorage, and they planned to build a hut there. With my experience in both mountaineering and mountaintop construction, when I built an observatory on top of Haleakala on Maui in the summer of 1961, I was a shoo-in for the job. The pay was good, and I reasoned that, having spent one summer on top of a mountain in Hawaii, I should spend another on top of a mountain in Alaska. However, this time there was a catch. My roommate and now longtime climbing partner Dick Springate had planned a trip to climb a new route on Mount Logan, which is the highest peak in Canada, and he wanted me to join the team. Having climbed Denali and Orizaba, the lure of Mount Logan was almost overpowering, since it would complete North America's Big Three, the 3 highest peaks in the continent, which just also happened to be the highest peak in each of the continent's 3 largest countries. Dick had done his research and had picked out a beautiful unclimbed ridge on Logan's north side, and the lure of an unclimbed route on a major peak was now more important to me than it had been when Joff and I had roamed around in the Flatirons. Dick's Logan expedition would take longer than our Denali climb had, and I would not be able to do the climb then zoom to the job as I had done in 1963. I had to choose between the climb and the job. Each had their pluses, and the choice tormented me through the spring. Dick continued to hound me to go on the Logan trip while the Institute's ring rolled by on the merry-go-round. If the Institute job had been behind a desk in Fairbanks, I would have gone to Logan. However, the Institute job, while not a climb, was a significant mountain adventure and would pay me more than enough to complete my degree. I had invested heavily in my degree and sensing that the time for the degree was now, but that I would have future opportunities to climb Logan, I chose the Institute job. When I arrived at the Glen Allen Airfield, I saw not one but 3 significant mountains to the east and knew that it was going to be a good summer. Arrayed from south to north for my viewing pleasure were the curious 14,163-foot Mount Wrangell, 12,010-foot Mount Drum, and 16,237-foot Mount Sanford. Rising in a long, low sweep, Wrangell was the least impressive of the 3 peaks, and since Glen Allen is only at 1,500 feet, I found it hard to believe that Wrangell is over 14,000 feet high. However, while not steep, Wrangell is indeed a high, snowy mountain, and a volcano. I liked that. Cupping my eyes for a better look, I saw that Wrangell was thoroughly white and held features that had escaped my initial tourist glance. After consulting the huge wall map in the pilot's lounge and realizing that Wrangell was 57 miles from the airfield, I knew that these were all huge mountains. Looking again at the map, I realized that these peaks were just the western sentinels of the vast Wrangell-St. Elias range that extended for 400 miles to the east-southeast and contained Mount Logan, Mount St. Elias, and a host of other high peaks. On Denali, I had been focused on three great mountains, but here I sensed that I had an entire new universe to explore. I paced the edge of the runway, nervously waiting for my chance to begin. The Institute had chosen Wrangell, a dormant volcano, for one simple reason. The volcano's heat had melted the snow along one of the ridges near Wrangell's summit, and this pumice platform provided a snow-free place to build the research hut in an otherwise glaciated landscape. Having just emerged from Das Cave, I was skeptical of this plan. How could the temperature be just right? What if it was too hot and the building burned up? What if it was too cold and the snows returned to bury the building, or worse, to create steam caves? I knew that we would have to dig into the pumice to create a level foundation, and this would increase the emerging heat. Squinting again at Wrangell, I saw a plume of smoke, or perhaps it was steam, emerging from the southern end of the summit plateau. After a closer look at the map, I realized that Wrangell had an inner, more active crater at the south end of a 5-mile-long caldera, and that the hut ridge was at the caldera's higher northern end. Still smelling Das Cave, I knew full well that dormant is not the same as extinct. What if the volcano erupted? Immensely eager to get the answers to all these questions, I paced the runway at high speed, then broke into a run to relieve my tension. After several days of waiting, my runway sprints had slowed back to a walk. The major party to the research grant was the Army, and they were going to supply the helicopters and pilots for the airlift of people and materials to Wrangell's summit caldera. But where were they? While waiting at the airfield, I got to know Jack Wilson, the civilian glacier pilot who was the Sheldon of the Wrangell-St. Elias range. Jack did not sprint across the runway and disappear like Sheldon had, and I found it easy to catch him. When he sauntered up puffing on a pipe, he usually went into the hangar to fiddle with his Super Cub, then retired to the pilot's lounge to get a donut, cup of coffee, and refill his pipe. All I had to do was stake myself out in the pilot's lounge, open the window, and wait for Jack to come to me. Once I had him in the lounge, I just pointed at some new part of the giant wall map, which covered most of the Wrangell-St. Elias range, and asked, "What about this peak?" Then, stirring creamer into his coffee, Jack would look intently at the map, and with a faraway look in his eyes, tell his tales. Jack had as many stories as Sheldon, and I was fortunate to hear them firsthand, since in 1964, Jack knew more about the Great Range than anyone. I suspected that, like Sheldon, Jack would win his wager with the wind. After Jack left the lounge to fiddle with his Cessna, I remained with the map and planned 100 future expeditions. I had no idea that events half a world away were delaying my Wrangell ride. When an old Army helicopter did arrive for a reconnaissance flight over the mountain, I immediately dashed up and asked to go along. The crew, while sympathetic, denied my request, since the insurance agreement between the Army and the Institute was not yet in place. I paced along the edge of the runway in bitter disappointment while the chopper rumbled off toward the peaks. When the crew returned, they told me about Wrangell, and also about the new Vietnam War that was consuming the Army's best efforts. Now I knew what had caused the delay, and it seemed to me like the world was speeding up. First, we barely escaped from the Cuban Missile Crisis in October 1962, then Kennedy was assassinated in November 1963, and now there was a new war to go get the Reds. The pilots also told me that all the best choppers were already in Vietnam, and that this project would have to be done with old equipment. That was a problem, since their current bucket of bolts had not been able to fly over Wrangell's summit. Then the crew hopped back into their aging machine and rumbled off, leaving me alone again. As I paced the runway, I knew that the Cold War was heating up. Finally, the Army appropriated two tougher Huey helicopters and some experienced pilots who were under the crisp orders of Colonel Allen. After a week-long flurry of noisy, dangerous, blade-spinning excitement, I was on top of Wrangell with a six-person construction crew and a small mountain of equipment and hut parts. Not surprisingly, after flying from 1,500 feet to 14,000 feet, the rest of the crew immediately disappeared into our tents to nurse their altitude headaches. This was the research program's first result. Such a rapid ascent is not a good idea. After my recent camping expedition on top of Rainier, I had no trouble with the altitude and took advantage of this small Das Cave compensation by organizing my new crater camp. For 1964, our prefabricated hut was quite an ingenious arrangement. The 16 by 20 foot hut had 18 separate 4 by 8 foot panels, which connected edge to edge by a clever hook and grab system that we tightened with a special tool until the two panels were seamless. Four of the wall panels had double pane windows. The 10-panel flat roof was supported in the middle by two 10-foot beams and a center column. The roof and sides were insulated, but the plywood floor was not, in hopes that the volcano's heat would travel through the floor and heat the hut. Before leaving Seattle, I had visited the factory in nearby Everett that had built the hut. In the flat, warm warehouse at sea level, my trial assembly of the hut had gone without a hitch, and I had assembled it in half a day. On top of Alaska's mighty Mount Wrangell at 14,000 feet, the assembly would take us 2 weeks. After several back-tweaking, lung-straining days, we had a large hand-dug foundation pit for the hut. As I once again found myself hacking away at the pumice trying to create a level place to sleep, I couldn't help thinking about Das Cave, especially since our construction site smelled a lot like my pack. The smell of desperate fear and death were not here, but the rest of it was. Our young expedition still held many unanswered questions, and beyond the initial excitement, this new volcano definitely had my attention. Once again, I found myself peering into the underworld looking for steam vents and finding them. I was now an expert in producing pumice platforms, but this was not a skill I wanted to admit to on my resume. At least this time there was no snow over my head, and if I needed fresh air, I would walk away to one of the nearby snowy summits and perch there. I carefully scanned the surrounding terrain for any sign of Das Cave II. After we assembled the walls, we discovered that the hut was not square and would not accept the roof panels, since the clever attachment fittings needed to line up exactly. Our foreman, Eldon Thompson, tackled this challenge like an Everest, and after setting several anchors, we cranked the hut into shape with a come-along, until the hooks settled into their slots with a satisfying click. This effort reminded me of the track team's old crevasse rescue drill. The next day we hung the front door and moved into our pumice palace, just as a vicious storm started. The tents were still pitched, and for the first time in my climbing career, I stood at a window in my T-shirt watching a tent bending in a raging white wind. The tent survived, but after the storm we discovered some bent poles and packed the no longer necessary tents away. After sealing the hut and adding an enclosed entryway and a volcano-heated snow melting system, our pumice palace became a home. On its appointed day, a large army plane flew over to drop us some 50-gallon fuel drums. We heard the plane's roar, but could not see it due to some pesky clouds that liked the summit as much as we did. After several circles, the plane discharged its precious cargo into the clouds, and we spent several days finding and retrieving the drums from their 10-foot-deep craters. One by one, we ferried the drums back to the palace on our early version of a snowmobile called an Arctic Cat. With our basic construction complete, the crew was ready to head back to Fairbanks for R&R. Several days later, Colonel Allen made several valiant attempts to reach the site in his Huey, but once again clouds ruled the runway. He finally did land in a near whiteout and hollered, "It's really too dangerous to take any of you off, but if one of you wants to try, hop in." Of course, I hopped in. After strapping in, Colonel Allen hollered one more instruction, which was, "Don't touch anything!" Because of the high altitude, the Huey had to slide down a runway like an airplane to get airborne, and after we did that, we were flying into the worsening storm. To escape the storm, Colonel Allen turned back toward the unseen summits, which we were below, and I suddenly realized the peril we were in. Flying by the seat of his pants in a complete whiteout, Colonel Allen flew through the small valley between two summits and emerged into open skies below. Releasing a huge sigh, I realized the tension that Colonel Allen had been under, but I also felt that he still had a demon on his back. Demon or no demon, I resolved to be a little less hasty next time in my dash for comfort. Back in Fairbanks, I became an Army laboratory guinea pig, a duty that the Institute's job description had not mentioned. First, I had a detailed physical, then suffered through a max oxygen saturation test. With a tube-infested heavy wooden box over my head, the testers instructed me to pedal a stationary bicycle at a steady rate while they steadily increased the resistance. A rolling pen chart recorded what percentage of the available oxygen my lungs were able to extract. After 50%, the effort became more interesting and I started concentrating. At 60%, I was working hard and cursing the box on my head. At 70%, I was only able to steal an occasional glance at the chart, but I was still able to curse my horrible hat. At 80%, the tester ran out of the room to call some other officers, since he had never seen a reading this high. At 85%, I was in a finishing froth, while a collection of officers huddled around the chart, ignoring my pain. At 90%, they pointed excitedly at the chart, while I roared in my headdress, nearly expiring from my effort. 93% was as far as I could go, and the research program had another data point. I knew nothing about these numbers, but gathered that mine was a high reading. Back at the Institute, I armed myself with a pack full of books, which included Hemingway's The Snows of Kilimanjaro. Then Jack Wilson flew Eldon Thompson, Emil Peel, and me back up to the Pumice Palace for the rest of the summer. The Vietnam War was now tugging harder at the Army's resources, and Wilson would supply our air support for the rest of the summer. Jack enjoyed the extra cash that his contract provided and promised to take good care of us. Back at the palace, we had an answer to one of our questions. The palace had not burned down. Carefully opening the door, we felt a rush of hot air and immediately wondered if it was too hot. The initial temperature in the hut was 87 degrees, but after airing it out, we had it back to our usual comfortable 65 degrees. On this second visit, we had many additional tasks to accomplish, including building a generator hut and installing a wiring system. After we installed a generator, we had much better radio communications with the base station in Glen Allen, but the first report we received shook us to the core. Colonel Allen was dead. Colonel Allen had one more flying job to do before heading for Vietnam, but this time the cloud he flew through had a mountain in it. His fatal flight was unrelated to our project, but huddling in the Pumice Palace, tweaking the radio dial to better hear the shocking news, I felt the Vietnam War's long finger pointing at me. All the headless figure behind the fingers said was, "Your turn will come." Not ready to face the rest of the world, I just grieved for Colonel Allen. As summer rolled into August, we had more free time and our summit explorations went farther afield. One day, we went as near as we dared to the steam-spewing southern crater. But with dips, pits, and holes everywhere, I felt like I had arrived in Das Cave Land and was happy to leave this devil's playground unexplored. However, it seemed determined to explore us. When the crater's stinky steam cloud roiled high into the air over us and blotted out the sun, we retreated back to the palace. The next day the cloud boiled higher still, and we wondered if the palace was far enough away from Das Cave Land. As the cloud consumed the sky, we felt like our 5-mile separation was indeed insufficient, and wondered if the mighty Mount Wrangell was coming to life for a major eruption. The towering cloud worried us for 3 days, then it slowly calmed down. What we saw was steam, not ash, and it is likely that a huge collapse occurred in the depths of Das Cave Land, sending enormous volumes of snow plummeting down onto the hot floor of the mother of all Das Caves. As I fearfully watched this impressive display, I knew that Das Cave was still with me and resolved to make no further explorations toward the Mother Cave. However, my next trip in the opposite direction gave me another shock. Determined to get a good look at Wrangell's North Slope, I drove the Arctic Cat through the Valley of Fuel Drum fame. Then when the slope became too steep for my machine, I parked it and continued down to the north on foot. It was a nice day, and the view of Mount Sandford from here was stunning. Below me, I also spotted Wrangell's northern outlier peak, 13,009-foot Mount Zanetti. Even though I had explored most of Wrangell's summits, I did not consider that I had climbed Mount Wrangell, since I had been airlifted up there, and I was itching for some untainted action. Squatting, I studied the smooth slope down to the Wrangell's Zanetti Col, which was not steep enough to require crampons. Suddenly, I jumped up and strode off down the slope in climb mode, figuring that I could climb Zanetti and get back before Eldon or Emil missed me. I was alone and unroped, but we had been running around on these smooth slopes unroped all summer. Partway down, I felt the snow give way under my feet, and falling, I thought I was a goner. I assumed that I was plunging into a crevasse, but after 3 feet, I stopped. The thump, thump, thump of settling snow radiated from my position in a receding wave as far as I could discern. I had just experienced the mother of all thump instants. Unstable snow below the surface had given way, dropping the harder, wind-packed snow top layer down. Normally these settlings only drop a few inches and stay within a few feet of the person who sets them off, but they clearly are a weak snowpack talking. In this case, perhaps heat from below the surface had weakened the snowpack. If snow, this was Das Cave talking. I was fine, but I could not convince my trembling legs of that, so without another glance at Zanetti, I turned and climbed back to the Arctic Cat, knowing that there would be no further explorations toward Zanetti either. I spent my remaining free time perching on one of the two easy summits that flanked the palace, and on good days even read my books there. I never tired of looking southeast toward the interior of the Wrangell-St. Elias Range. From my perch peak, I had a good view of 16,390-foot Mount Blackburn, and knowing that this was one of the range's stellar summits, I studied it carefully, looking for routes. Of course, by the end of the summer, I had resolved to climb it someday. Beyond Blackburn, I only had distant glimpses of North America's greatest mountain playground. But from my map work, I knew that Bona, Lucania, Logan, St. Elias, and a host of other peaks were out there waiting. I felt that this range was full of potential future summits and knew that I had a destiny there. Wilson flew over the next day and dropped us some supplies. Jack preferred to drop us care packages rather than land, since a landing at 14,000 feet with his small Super Cub was still a big event. It was always a cheery sight when Wilson flew over wagging his wings and his care package sailed through the air, made me feel like Christmas. This time his present contained ice cream, but Eldon and Emil thought that eating vanilla ice cream on a glacier made no sense, so the half gallon became mine. I ate a little bit and found it to be the most wonderful item that I had tasted all summer, so I carefully stowed the remaining treasure in the snow. To my horror, when I checked it a few hours later, it was melting. Doss Cave's fingers were in the snow, and it was not cold enough. So I cursed Doss Cave, then immediately had my revenge by eating the rest of the half gallon. Thereafter, when Wilson's packages sailed down, I applied the pacing tactic that I had learned in the Fairview after Denali, and ate the entire half gallon in one sitting. This became another skill that never made it onto my resume. With the days rapidly becoming shorter, we needed our light in the late evenings to illuminate our hearts' games. Eldon was a master of the moonshot and delighted in tormenting Emil and me, so we teamed up and plotted crash landings for Eldon. A week later, I did my last 360 on Perch Peak, looking at the splendor that had held me all summer. In spite of various adventures and misadventures, the summer had been wonderfully peaceful. I knew that the rest of the world would soon consume me, but for the moment I was alone and free where I wanted to be. Only when I heard Wilson's cub coming for me did I descend from Perch Peak. Folding my lanky torso into the tiny cub one more time, I waved goodbye to the gleaming pumice palace and fastened my seatbelt. In sharp contrast to the noisy army choppers that had originally brought me up here, Wilson's cub seemed like a silent winged angel as it lifted off and banked over Doss Cave land. As Jack turned toward Glenallan and put the cub's nose down for our descent, I also waved goodbye to Doss Cave. The combination of Rainier and Wrangell created a colorful second movement for my Northern Mountain Symphony that moved my music in an unexpected direction. My score was not bound by traditional rules. Stay tuned for Chapter 4 from Northern Heights, and we will delve deeper into the Wrangell-St. Elias range.